Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Courageous Apostle. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of the 16th century friar St. Lawrence of Brindisi, saying his witness serves as an excellent example for our age, so fraught with violence, ethical relativism, and religious indifference. Stoicism and resilience in Japan. We find out how the people in northeastern Japan are coping with their nation's triple disaster of earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear crisis. Minting and printing. We shine the spotlight on the long and fascinating history of papal coins and medals, Vatican coins and stamps, and examine some of the most famous and unusual examples from this rich heritage. And God in the Wilderness. Listen to this reflection from Scottish Jesuit priest Chris Bowles, who urges us to get into nature or the wilderness this Lent, because that is where we can meet and connect with God. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of St. Lawrence of Brindisi, the 16th century friar, saying his witness serves as an excellent example for our age, so fraught with violence, ethical relativism, and religious indifference. Emma McCarthy reports.
The general audience returned to St. Peter's Square Wednesday, a clear sign that spring has arrived in Rome, with more than 10,000 pilgrims and tourists filling Bernini's colonnade with bright flags and banners. Pope Benedict XVI toured the square in his Pope-mobile, waving warmly to the crowds before he took his place on the raised platform in front of the basilica's façade.
Dear brothers and sisters, our catechesis today focuses on St. Lawrence of Brindisi, a Capuchin friar of the 16th and early 17th centuries, coming of age at a time when many of the articles of the faith were being called into question. St. Lawrence applied his immense talents to making clear the biblical and patristic foundations of the teachings of the Church.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict continued that, with a clear and calm explanation, St. Lawrence showed the biblical and patristic basis of all articles of faith challenged by Martin Luther. Pope Benedict noted that the success St. Lawrence enjoyed helps us to understand that even today, in carrying forward ecumenical dialogue with great hope and enthusiasm, our approach to sacred scripture read in the tradition of the Church is indispensable and of fundamental importance.
The son of the Franciscan tradition also applied himself heroically to efforts towards peace and reconciliation between the nations and peoples of Europe. His witness serves as an excellent example for our age, so fraught with violence, ethical relativism, and religious indifference. The new evangelization needs well-prepared, zealous, and courageous apostles, like St. Lawrence, so that the light and beauty of the gospel may reach into the depths of every human heart.
Heal the world, make it a better place.
Then, to the notes of the St. Anne and St. Ibbs School's choir, Pope Benedict concluded with a prayer.
Ein Wort God's abundant blessings.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Fears about radiation clouds from Japan's damaged Fukushima nuclear complex are continuing to grip the attention of the world's media. But this is just one element in the country's worst ever disaster, unleashed by the earthquake and tsunami on March the 11th, that devastated many coastal areas of northeastern Japan. With about 21,000 people dead or missing, over 300,000 evacuated, and 2.4 million people without access to water, the scale of the humanitarian crisis is huge. Father Desuki Naru is the executive director of Caritas Japan and is currently in the earthquake-hit city of Sendai. He told me that despite their difficulties, the local people are being stoic and are quick to offer help to others in need.
Well, the people in Sendai, they are very calm and they encourage each other. They are very generous to give food to others. So I don't see any confusion in Sendai city. But on the other hand, in the most affected areas, which is tsunami-affected area, I heard that the situation is grave and people try to get food. Sometimes they even get into the broken-down houses to seek food or money. Yeah, things like that. So it's a contrast, Sendai and then tsunami-affected area.
And how would you describe then the plight of those made homeless by this disaster?
In the evacuation center in Sendai city, they get enough food, enough blanket. But in a tsunami hit area, they still need more food, more blanket, and more petrol to get heater. Everything they need more. But it is very difficult to distribute materials to those areas because the phone connection is still not available in that area, and roads are still full of debris, so difficult to access there. So the situation is like that.
And can you tell us, how is Caritas helping the people there in Sendai City or in the surrounding areas?
In Sendai City, we send volunteers from many parts of Japan to the volunteer center, so-called volunteer center. Then they provide volunteer work for our volunteers. They go with evacuees to their house to clean up their houses. Sometimes it's a house, sometimes it's a company building, and sometimes it's a road work, mainly to clean up cities and houses. That's one thing. And also, we provide some food for soup kitchen service for evacuees in Sendai City. And we are also planning to send doctors and nurses, mainly they are Catholics, volunteer, provide a medical service for evacuees, and then they come from many parts of Japan.
What is the hygiene situation like in these evacuation centres or where the homeless people are staying? I mean, are they able, for instance, to bathe, to have a shower, or is that impossible?
It's impossible. It's even impossible for me in Sendai City. We have water, but there is no gas, so we can't get hot water. In Japan is now winter. It's very difficult to have cold water shower, so there's no shower service. And in evacuation shelter, some people got flu. They worry about this. They try to put a mask, but it's very difficult to wash their hand because of shortage of water.
And so are doctors there worried that there'll be soon more serious illnesses maybe spreading between the people given these unhygienic situation?
Yeah, doctors say they are afraid because there are so many people, same house, same center.
And do most of the evacuees only have the clothes on their backs?
Well, I'm not so sure. Maybe in some of the centers, they are provided new cloth. But at the same time, I heard that there are shortage of underwear, both men and women, and then children and babies.
And is sufficient aid arriving from overseas to help in this ongoing relief effort?
Yes. And materials, aid is there. But the problem is how to distribute and then bring it. We are facing serious shortage of gasoline, and it's very difficult to get gasoline, so we can't drive car here. So the problem is distribution.
Do you have any specially memorable or poignant stories to tell about a survivor's experience that illustrate what these people have been going through?
Well, I was impressed. This Sendai area, it's kind of a rural area, and many young people go to Tokyo or other big cities. So there are many elderly people in this area, not so many young people. And the situation is same for Catholics. If you go to Sunday Mass, there are only 10 Catholics. All of them are elderly people. But after the earthquake, about 40 people come to that parish, which usually get only 10 Catholics for Sunday Mass. It means they prefer to pray and to attend Mass rather than clean up their house or seeking food. They prefer attending Mass in such a disaster situation. It's very moving.
They are seeking comfort in God, you're saying?
Yes, yes.
What do some of these people say about their situation? You said that people are very calm and they are helping others. Are people being very stoic and resilient?
Well, what I see and what I talk with people is just they are offering service. I came to Sendai to help people, but the people I see, they offer service for me. Do you need any service? They say to me. It's amazing, but that's their attitude.
What message, if any, can we learn, can the people learn from this terrible triple disaster for Japan?
Well, after this earthquake, I received so many emails from all over the world saying, we are praying for you. We are one as a one family. I think the help through material is important, but the prayer is also very, very important to help people. It does encourage people here in Sendai, in affected area. So my message is prayer has big power to support people, to encourage people. That's what I feel every day here.
I was speaking to Father Daisuke Naru, Executive Director of Caritas Japan, who's in the earthquake-hit city of Sendai. The history of papal coinage goes back nearly 1,300 years, and the coins struck often reflect the colourful and sometimes turbulent history of the papacy over the centuries. Since 1929, the Vatican City State has issued sets of commemorative coins and stamps several times a year that have become prized items for collectors around the globe. After the advent of the euro, the Vatican was granted the right in 2001 to issue its own euro coins. There is also a Vatican Philatelic and Numismatic Museum that attracts many visitors each year. Founded in 2007, the museum showcased the entire Vatican City State stamp and coin production from 1929 to present. This week saw the Vatican's Philatelic Office issuing its first set of commemorative stamps for this year. The latest issues were marking the 150th anniversary of Italy's unification, the 2011 Year of the Forest, and the third centenary of Father Eusebio Chini. Peter Gensis is a US numismatist who specializes in Vatican coins and also acts as a dealer for the tiny state stamps. He says the Vatican's commemorative stamp issues are always very popular with collectors.
Oh, there's a high level of interest in each new issue. I think the Vatican chooses its themes and its designs very carefully, often selecting special artists to do the work. And these stamps, of course, are available for sale at the Vatican itself.
So they're very much prized by collectors. And does that mean collectors all over the world, or is it mainly in the West?
Well, I think Vatican stamps pull in collectors from throughout the world. The U.S. maybe can be a little special. Germany certainly shows a lot of interest in the stamps of Vatican City. But as a special nation, it draws collectors from throughout the world.
What have been, to your knowledge, the most valuable or striking or unusual set of stamps ever issued by the Vatican that have really, you know, made their mark on history?
Well, the most valuable set of stamps is from 1934. And, in 1934, the Vatican took the original issue from 1929 and surcharged it with new values. This set is very rare and will run about $2,000.
Turning to the papacy's coinage, what are some of the most memorable and unusual examples of coins minted in the past centuries? Which are the most valuable examples? And who are some of the famous artists who designed them? Alan Berman is an expert in medieval and papal coins and author of two books on the subject, Papal Coins and Papal Numismatic History. He began by explaining to me why he became fascinated by the history of papal coins.
I was brought to papal coins as a teenager by three things. One, I am a great fan of the Middle Ages, and I see the papacy as being the most intact medieval institution that Western civilization has preserved. There are many, many medieval institutions, but the papacy is essentially intact. Also, I am a great fan of Baroque art and the papal coinage, and even architecture, for that matter, is just a wonderful sampling of Baroque art. The coinage of the Rome Mint, especially in 1600s, is just beautiful. And lastly, and this is going to sound perhaps fairly trivial, I have, since my childhood, loved great big copper coins. And in the 16 and 17 and 1800s, the papal mint produced wonderful copper coins that looked like they could be milk chocolate candy bars.
But what are the earliest papal coins still in existence? Peter Jensis tells us more about when the long history of minting papal coins began.
That's a very good question. The coins of the Pope starts in the 8th century, and these earliest coins, sometimes they could be as simple as having the design of a cross on them. Later, they become more works of art, I think, certainly by the Renaissance, and so the papal mint has always used talented artists and engravers for their coins and medals.
Have there been any really famous names that have been used for this purpose?
Oh, well, no less an artist than Benvenuto Cellini made works for Clement VII in the 16th century, and Bernini would do so in the 17th century.
Now, on the front of a coin, there would usually be the bust of a pope. But what about on the reverse side? What have they included, you know, apart from presumably biblical scenes?
Yes, you're absolutely right. On the front or the obverse of the coin will often, most often, contain the name of the pope, certainly, and his year of reign. The reverse side, the popes did many things. They would use it for perhaps spiritual messages or to record their accomplishments.
Obviously, the election of a new pope was presumably the main prompter for minting a new set of coins. But what were some of the other notable reasons in the past centuries that spring to mind?
Well, you know, there are two major examples that come to mind. There's a special series of coins issued for each holy year or jubilee year. This occurs at least every 50 years and often more recently every 25 years. This would be the call for pilgrims to visit Rome and the holy basilicas. Now, the other special issue is the sede vacante issue. That stands for vacant seat. That's the period for which there is no pope, where the cardinals are in conclave looking to elect a new pope. For every period, coins and stamps are issued for that.
And I imagine those are very quickly snapped up, because obviously it's only a finite and fairly brief period.
Oh, absolutely right. Sometimes these periods can last less than 30 days. And in 2005, following the death of John Paul II, there was quite a interest in sede vacante issues. There were lines at the Vatican for the new issue of stamps.
Berman says the reverse sides of the papal coins are among the most varied and creative to be found on Western coinage. So in his view, what are some of the most striking designs?
One of the most inspiring coins is, in fact, the frontispiece of my book, Papal Coins. It's a 2.5 by oki piece struck in copper, which depicts St. Peter looking over his shoulder. At the same time, there were three different engravers designs being struck. Two of them are in fact quite boring, but one shows what it was like to be Peter in the first century when you knew that you were one of the leaders of a cult that was illegal and could get you killed. It really gives a sense of urgency, and I really regret that with radio you cannot actually see it, but it depicts him having a concerned expression. He's looking over his shoulder. He is holding the keys to the kingdom as though he were guarding it from Romans that would desecrate it. It's very, very inspiring. Another coin is very, very recent. Well, by the way, the piece I just mentioned is from the 1790s. Another very inspiring piece is from the 1950 Holy Year, and it has the Dove of Peace flying before the Dome of St. Peter's. Those two certainly would be very, very inspiring art.
Let's return now to Peter Jensis to find out which are his personal favorites among the past designs on papal or Vatican coins.
I recall a small silver coin from Pope Pius XI and Pius XII that shows St. Peter in a boat amidst a storm. And this is an ancient or a very old Christian symbol of the boat as the church, guided by God and providing a source of refuge.
So, in other words, these designs are often reflecting or giving us an insight into the mood or the burning issues of the period they came from. So, presumably, when that was minted, the church was felt to be going through a stormy period.
Well, certainly, stormy periods are not uncommon. I think also the period when the Pope started to lose a lot of the land they controlled within Italy. This is in the 1800s.
The popes didn't just issue coinage, but they also issued medals, medallions, didn't they? Can you give us some examples of some of those? I gather, for instance, there was even one issued when Vatican Radio was set up.
That's absolutely right. The medals have a special tradition and an old tradition. It starts in about the 1400s, and later there would be a tradition for minting at least one medal every year that we call the annual medal. That tradition continues today. The Vatican Radio Medal is a very beautiful medal. That's in 1931. The medal was issued commemorating the opening. In fact, the Pope gave a gold version of this medal to Marconi for his efforts.
And what does it show?
Well, it shows angels flying above the radio tower.
Okay, well, yes, of course, Vatican Radio's patron saint is the angel Gabriel, so that's very appropriate. Coming to the makeup of the coins, in the past, I gather they were generally minted in precious materials, at least for the larger values like silver or gold or else copper and bronze. But nowadays, how many are still made of silver and gold? Just the commemorative ones? Should we say the everyday coinage is usually nickel alloys now, isn't it?
That's correct. The modern gold coins from the Vatican and silver are commemorative coins, and they're intended for collectors. But the mintages are fairly low. For example, recent gold issues, Vatican only minted about 2,800 per year.
And what are the most valuable of these older papal coins? Can you give us a few examples?
Well, as you might guess, in the older coins and medals, gold, no surprise, tend to be the most valuable. And they're rare not only for their age, in many cases, but over the years, many coins and medals would have been melted, or there may have been some external factors. The French looted Vatican City around 1808, and no doubt many precious items were lost. As far as silver coins go, older coins can be quite large and have beautiful designs, as I mentioned, from famous artists. There's the coin of St. Peter that we talked about. There's one from around 1700, and a good example of this coin could cost $3,000 or so.
And when you say $3,000, is that the most expensive price for any papal coin, or are some of the prices even higher?
Oh, even higher. The gold coins and the gold medals can often run in the tens of thousands of dollars. That's no surprise, really, because in many cases there could be one or two examples of this coin or medal that survive.
I was speaking to Peter Jensis, a U.S. numismatist specializing in Vatican coins. And earlier you heard the voice of Alan Berman, an expert on papal coins and the author of two books on this subject. Just as Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days to fast and reflect, Scottish Jesuit priest Chris Bowles urges us to try to get into nature or the wilderness this Lent so we can meet and connect with God the Creator. Let's listen now to his reflection.
One of Scotland's greatest exports is its people. And one Scot who left for America at the age of 11 is a particularly good example of that greatness. He's John Muir. He was a conservation pioneer. He's known as the father of the National Parks of America. And he saw God in every mountain, every drop of rain, and every blade of grass. He's reminded us of the vital importance of getting into nature, of going into the wilderness every now and then, because that's where we can meet God. And that's where we can allow God to nourish us. Muir puts it very beautifully. Everybody needs beauty as well as bread, he says. Places to play in and pray in, where nature may heal and cheer and give strength to body and soul alike. We're now in the beautiful season of Lent, and the very fact that we call it a season is a reminder of its rootedness in nature. We spend 40 days preparing ourselves to enter deeply the Paschal mystery of the Passion and the Resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that we do this for 40 days is no accident. That's, of course, the time that Jesus spent alone in the wilderness. Scripture tells us that at the end of his 40 days, the tempter came to him. But I often wonder what else happened to him in those 40 days. He had this opportunity to do what John Muir proposed, and he went to a place where nature could heal and cheer and give strength. He needed great strength, strength to withstand the temptations, to fast, to prepare for the public ministry that was to come for him. But it all began in a place of wilderness and wildness, and I like that very much. Gerard Manley Hopkins was also a Jesuit. He was a wonderful poet, and for a brief time he too worked in Scotland, as I do. And that gave him many opportunities to experience the great beauty of this country. After a visit to the shores of Loch Lomond, he wrote a very beautiful poem entitled Inversnaid. And here's a little sample of that poem. What would the world be once bereft of wet and wildness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. Long live the wilderness indeed. It's in the wilderness that we connect to the beauty of creation. And in that beauty, we meet the creator of it all. We also meet ourselves, as Jesus did, including that part of himself that had to face up to the complexity of life, the choices, invitations, and temptations that are real for every one of us. That's why our 40 days of Lent are such a wonderful and God-given opportunity to grow in faith. We may not spend all of it in the wet and wildness, but we ought at least to spend some of it there. Whether it's a dusty desert, a mountain vista, a back garden or a city park, I encourage you, do try to connect with nature and with creation during Lent. Because I promise you that once you are there, the Creator will definitely connect with you.
That reflection came from Father Chris Bowles, Superior of the Lauriston Jesuit Community in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.